Hey, everybody. Welcome to CCW Podcast. This is Dagny.
Hey, it's Al.
This is going to be our first podcast on the road. We're on a vacation. Episode 10. I'm going to be doing a little bit more of the talking since Al's doing all the driving.
We're on vacation, people.
We're going to call this episode Dagny Gets Schooled. This is going to be kind of a recap of my CCW class experience from last Saturday now, so a week ago today. Before we dig into that subject matter, we'll just say that if everything goes as planned on our vacation, we might have a couple of surprises in the next few podcasts. I don't want to spoil it any further than that, but we're excited to have some surprise content coming up, hopefully. And I think that's the only kind of housekeeping stuff. If you want to email us, as always, ccwpodcast@gmail.com is our email, either Al or I. And now for the demographics of the class. It was around 25 people showed up. There were a couple of people who'd already taken the class and were there, kind of like Al was there for me, just brush up on the...
To give you a background, my class, there was only about 12 people there, and it was, for me, I thought it was a packed crowd. So to see over double the amount of people taking the class, that was pretty cool to see. And it wasn't very, very bad weather, snowy, slippery, icy. And still, everyone showed up pretty much, except for, I think, one person. So
yeah, it was
good
pretty...
to see that everyone's trying to get their carry permit.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. For the most part, the group was pretty young, around our ages.
Yeah, yeah.
There were four couples, including ourselves, so there were three other ladies present.
Yeah.
And there were two groups of, like, an older gentleman and a younger gentleman. We weren't sure if they were, like, father-son or just, you know, friends that drove together, but that was kind of an interesting thing to note, too. Do you have anything else to chip in on the demographics that you noted, Al?
It always surprises me to see people in there from different age groups and people you wouldn't necessarily peg, you know, the middle-aged ladies, college-aged kids. You know, all shapes and sizes. It was really interesting to see, and every time I see people who are getting involved in the carry movement, it's very refreshing to me because, you know, you never know who it is that's going to be carrying. And the common denominator does seem to be people like who are very socially responsible and just generally good-natured people, you know.
There were the four couples, and those were the only women. So all of the women in the class were there with a man counterpart. I think two of the men were there for the class, and two of the men, like Al and then another man, had already gone through the course and just came to come and be supportive. And then there was something else. I don't know who all offers the courses, but we had some people who drove well over an hour to come to the course, which I thought was interesting. Al, do you know anything more about who offers and why they would have had to drive so far? Or?
The place that we went to, we're really lucky that we live within a half hour from them. My understanding is they've established a very strong regional reputation, and that kind of vetted out at when they asked people how far they came from, and they came from a good couple hours away drive. And, you know, like I said before, the roads were nasty, and you had to be there at about, you know, quarter to eight. So these people were driving,
The one guy said he had to hit the road at 6 a.m.
Yeah,
with the weather.
Butt crack of dawn. So it was impressive to see how far people came from, and the classroom portion and even the shooting portion has changed in little ways, and even in ways that I think streamlined the process this time around too. So it was interesting to see a rarity in the fact that I was able to sit down and witness the CCW process, classroom and range time, once as a participant, as a second time as an observer. So I feel very blessed that I was able to do that.
Yeah, and it reinforced, I'm sure, because a lot of the content, the, you know, the substantive content was just good to refresh it.
Oh, yeah. Even the stuff that was, you know, a repeat of my first time, it served to reinforce this information. You know, it was amazing to me what I remembered and what I'd forgotten and re-remembered from taking the class again. So that was, even of itself, I'm very grateful for the company for letting me do that, sit in and be there for you and for myself as well. So it was nice.
As for the class itself, I would say we were in the classroom portion for around 4 or 5 hours with just brief restroom breaks, maybe twice. And then we got an hour for lunch. And we're not going to go too much into the classroom portion. Al covered a lot of that in one of the prior episodes.
Yeah, CCW 201, if you want to learn a little bit more about the classroom. Future episodes will definitely break down some of the stronger elements, like psychological factors.
And I'll touch a little bit on that today, but...
Yeah, fundamentals of marksmanship. We'll get that down the road.
We want to really flesh it out. We don't want to just give another overview. It's a little redundant.
It'll be a 3-hour podcast, folks.
Yeah. So the biggest thing and the only thing I'll really talk about from the classroom portion is we took all 3 of our guns just to be prepared in case Al got to shoot. And based on the last episode, you know, the night before going into the class, I wasn't sure if I wanted to shoot the Glock or the car.
So what did you end up ultimately deciding on shooting?
I decided on the Glock, which might surprise some of our listeners that, you know, we've been conversing with through email. But it came down to, in the discussion of the elements that you...
The classroom discussion?
Yeah, in the classroom portion, they gave us the things you look at when you're choosing your defensive firearm. And... You know, there are 4 or 5 points, but by far the one that outweighs all the others was the functional reliability. And if you've listened to episode 9 from last Friday, I was really struggling because we hadn't fired the Glock or the car, but the Glock was chambering when we were just working with it at home perfect, and the car was not wanting to feed.
And then you also had sort of the reputations of both of those firearms, you know. Glock is many things, but one thing it is that it's very reliable. At least it has a reputation for so. And our Glock 19, I don't know if anyone, if we mentioned this, it's a Gen 3. It's not one of the newer Gen 4s that, if you follow the forums, there have been some reports of problems with the Gen 4s and even some of the late Gen 3s, I think. My Gen 3 is a little bit older. It looks flawless inside and out. And so Gen 3 Glock 19 has a pretty strong reputation as the best iteration of the Glock 19. So in the car, P380 has had some problems, you know, even to the point where there's a forum that tells you how to break in the car, and we hadn't really done much of that. So...
We've done some of that since then. We still haven't gotten to shoot the car. We're getting a little off topic now.
Yeah.
But,
I racked the slide on that car about 100 times already, and it's still really tight. So, there's still going to be, got to shoot it in, break it in, and go ahead.
So I did decide on the Glock during the class. You know, we had everything out in the car, in the parking lot, and I just, you know, I was looking at Al and going in, I guess I still wasn't 100% sure. I got up in the morning and I thought, well, if there's any time to test the car out and have problems, it would be when there's instructors around to maybe give advice. And then I thought, it's freezing cold, and the last thing I need is added anxiety with having the car not be reliable during the class, and I don't want to hold the class up and stuff. So I went ahead and went with the Glock, and I don't regret it at all.
I also think that with the car, I think, you know, knowing our personalities, I think we would have kind of preferred to break it in ourselves and kind of have it in our own private lane at a range and work through the problems and kind of not feel rushed. You know, last thing you want to do on these malfunctions is to rush it. You know, you really want to take it down, take your time, and use the proper, malfunction drill techniques. And, you know, the fine motor skill function and being out in the cold and have Dagny, you know, used fine motor skills and trying to work through it, I think may have been a confidence issue, and I wanted to make sure, and Dagny wanted to make sure that confidence was going to be in the firearm. And, you know, as we'll talk about later, the Glock 19 more than made up for that.
Right. And from previous podcasts, you'll know my only real gripe about the Glock when we rented one at the range was the grips. And I believe, Al, correct me if I'm wrong, that was a Gen 4.
Yeah, the problem that you had was with the Gen 4.
And the Gen 3, which is what we have of the Glock 19, the grips are still nubby. They're not as bad. It probably would have hurt me if it had been warm. And as it was, cold outside, I had my gloves on in between when I was called up to participate. I'll get into this a little bit more later. But as far as choosing the Glock, I left my glove on my right primary shooting hand, even when I was firing, so that it gave a little bit more cushion. And it worked out just fine. There were no issues with getting my finger in the trigger guard or anything like that. So it worked out perfect for me. And then I guess that leads us into the actual range time itself. After we got back from lunch, we just went straight to the range. And like I said, there were about 25 people. So there were a handful, like Al, who were just observing. They didn't actually, you know, fire on the range, although Al did get to shoot the Glock during a demonstration later on in the class. He'll talk about that in a little bit, but
woohoo!
Yeah, he liked it too. Because there were so many of us, they had several lanes set up with the targets, but we had to go in three different cycles. I was in group two, so they just started it on the drills, and they had us just use our hands to get used to, like, making sure we understood what the process was going to be and the calls and things like that. And of course, we had our eye and ear protection on. And I guess before I go into the specific drills, and I'm not going to go super in-depth on the drills, but just for people who are wondering what they could do at home to practice or whatever, you know, knowing what we did in class might give you a little bit of insight on what you could do. I don't know what availability is and restrictions at the ranges you have near you, but what I noticed reviewing the notes from the class is that they tried to simulate a high-stress situation, which hits on how you react psychologically to a situation where you would have to engage in a defensive way. And there were five points of how your body reacts in a situation. And Al, did you have anything to say before I dig into this content?
Maybe the people listening would want to know how you felt going into the class and going into the range portions, whether or not you were nervous, excited, prepared you felt, or, you know, maybe some ladies or some gentlemen out there are wondering, you know, how are you going to feel? Is there anything you could do to prepare the night before or going into class? I know we brought notebooks for notes, and I think that gave us an advantage over a lot of other people who didn't seem to bring any of the materials to write on.
Yeah, I was glad I brought my notebook, and honestly, Al had taken the class and kind of discussed a lot of the points with me already, so it was, in a sense, refresher for me, even though it was my first time going through. I did get to make a lot of connections. I would say he taught me the fundamentals, you know, never point the gun at anything you wouldn't be willing to shoot and keep your finger off of that trigger. Those kind of things he's clearly shared because we have guns in the house. But a lot of the other techniques and stuff he had kind of, I've learned because I've gone to like the ladies shoot events and I've been at the range.
Would you say that, you know, going to the range before and going to the ladies shoots prepared you for the class?
Absolutely. And I guess I've really only been to the range not even a solid handful of times, but it gave me plenty of confidence. I mean, they even remarked that when I was, you know, being instructed on the line to do certain things, I did it with some authority.
Yeah, I was beaming, very, very happy that they were very complimentary on your form. You know, obviously, you're a very fast learner and intelligent lady, but I'd like to take a little bit of credit in how good your form was and execution was. So.
Yep, very fitting. It's all because of Al. He, you know, sometimes I get annoyed. It's like, I'm learning. It's okay. I can be a little sloppy, but, you know, it showed. Even the little amount of practice I've had definitely showed, if nothing other than my mindset going into it. I wasn't afraid of the gun.
Yeah, and I'm realizing that, you know, times when I'm having videos about, you know, gunfighting and all that, I sometimes think that Dagny isn't listening or paying attention, doing her own thing, but I can definitely tell from her form that she's picking up some of the stuff that she's hearing and watching on videos, even if it's sort of on her peripheral vision and not her, you know. She's definitely soaking in the information, even though I'm not aware that she's actively listening, you know?
Yeah, I'm a sponge, I guess. So, I guess I'll kind of pull out what they did to try and highlight these psychological reactions as I talk about each of them.
Are you saying the psychological reactions, you're saying...
When you are in a defensive situation where you are going to have to use your weapon, these are common things that happen to you, are likely to happen, all or none, you know, any combination thereof. These are the primary symptoms, I guess you could call them.
Sure.
The first that we discussed was the loss of your fine motor skills, and not to go too physiological on it, but your blood is being redistributed and focused to your muscle groups for the fight or flight response. Am I right on that?
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, the blood will go from your extremities into your hearts and your large muscle groups to kind of prime them for a physical exertion of a magnitude that you're probably not going to be used to. So, you know, you can go into that, but like fine motor skills, like finger manipulations, are going to be deteriorated. And you know, you might even experience numbness in your hands. And
yeah, this is what Al has read a lot, and he refers to it, I think, as a power stroke to chamber.
That's what the Magpul guys call it, yeah. It's kind of an interesting name. You like what?
I have kind of coined my own phrase. It's a paw pull. You kind of just have, like, your hands in a mitten, and you use all of those four fingers on the one side of the slide, and you use that meaty butt part of your hand on the other to rack it. And that's because, like we were just talking about, the blood not being in your fingertips. You don't want to rely on just the tips of one finger or pulling it carefully. And another reason you don't want to use the slide lock release, and another reason that you want to carry chambered, because, you know, the more actions you have to go through that are going to require fine motor skills, you know, the worse off you are in this situation. And practice these gross motor skill methods as your primary method of chambering, because, as we've talked about before, when you find yourself in a situation where you're going to need these skills, you're going to default back to, you know, your lowest level of training. And if this is what you've trained on, you're not going to struggle with, I lost my fine motor skills, and you don't know how to do it with just using the gross motor skills.
Right. I mean, you want to do the paw pull, power stroke, whatever you want to call it, to chamber around into your firearm. If you're carrying with a cocked and locked, then you just want to disengage the thumb safety. If you're carrying with a round in a chamber, then you're just pulling the trigger on a Glock. However, the reason you want to learn these power strokes, paw pulls, whatever you want to call it, is, you know, if you need to reload a magazine, you're going to obviously want to do it that way as well, and not rely on releasing the slide lock to chamber a round, because releasing the slide lock is a fine motor skill and may require you to kind of, you know, take a little time and look at the gun sideways, and things that you will deter from you putting that gun on the target, you know?
Right. There's ways to use the slide itself mechanism to chamber using gross motor skills, but if you're relying on the slide lock release, there's no way around fine motor skills there. That's right. A really small tab. So the paw pull, as I call it, you've got the grip. Al's laughing at me. The paw pull. Maybe it's too girly or cute.
No, I like it. I like it.
But you have the grip of the gun in your firing hand. So I'm just going to assume most of us are righties, but just flip it if you're not. I'm holding it in my right hand and the magazine's in there, but I have to chamber. So I have to do the slide. And I might have to use a little more of my body behind chambering than Al would, just because I'm smaller and don't have as much upper body strength. So what I do is I kind of use from my hip. I have my arms very tight to my body. I make that paw with my left hand. So my fingers, my four fingers, are on the far side of the the slide, and the meaty part of my hand is on the near side, and I punch the gun and just have a tight hold with my paw hand.
Where is your paw hand in relation to the gun?
It's towards the back, like above where the grip is.
Okay.
And you want to make sure, I mean, this is important too, you don't want your skin in any way to be over where the fired round will eject and where it's chambering into, which actually Al mentioned that he was just working the slide on the car, and he actually got his first bite when he was doing that. Do you want to?
Yeah, it's not like a traditional bite where you're pulling the trigger on a semi-auto and it's the slide locking back and snapping your flesh in the web of your thumb and forefinger area. For me, it was me just not playing with the car, but kind of trying to loosen up the slide a little bit by racking it back and forth. And just one of the times I did that, I had my hand paw pulling over it, but I was definitely over the ejection port, and on the way back, it pinched me right where the ejection port and the slide met. So,
and I mean, to be fair, it wasn't necessarily Al's form. I was having the same problem when I was trying to just pull the slide back.
It's just such a tiny little firearm that I can't help but be over the ejection port. My hands aren't that big anyways. It's normal size, I would say. But, yeah, I just got a little lazy just racking it back and forth, and it caught and didn't draw blood, but it was a little discomforting. I mean, you know, I shook it off like a champion, but no, I'm just kidding. And anyways, yeah, it wasn't too bad. It was a lesson learned for me to watch where my palm is going to be, so.
Yep, so that was the first thing, is your loss of your fine motor skills. So that's the technique for chambering, using just your gross motor skills, that paw pull or the power stroke or whatever you want to call it. You're not using your fingertips or the slide lock release.
Yeah, put your hands, fingers together, make it look like a little hook, you know, a single hook rather than spread out fingers, you know. Keep that thumb tucked in by the side of your hand so it's not hanging out there, and then just kind of claw it, clamp, punch out with your right hand, let your left hand just lock in. You should be good to go.
Yep. The second point that they tried to simulate was tunnel vision. And it was cold, so some of us had hoods up, so that probably helped. But they had men at either end of the firing line that would hold up their hands and wiggle a certain number of fingers. And part of the drill after each thing that we were being instructed on was you had to scan left and right. And then they'd ask if you saw fingers, how many fingers, just to, you know, make you aware that you don't just fire at what's in front of you. Because oftentimes, if you're being confronted with a defensive situation, the perpetrator is going to be acting in pairs or more.
Yeah, bad guys sometimes don't run alone, right? I mean, we all know that there's strength in numbers for good and bad, and, you know, you get that mob mentality. And when that tunnel vision happens and you engage a target, they really did drill home that you got to look left, right, and when I say left and right, you even look behind your shoulders too when you're looking left and right, because who knows who's coming up behind you. So
yeah, you keep that gun pointed straight, what would be downrange, but you're scanning basically your full range of motion that you can go left and right.
Yeah, head on a swivel. You know, if you guys play football at all, you know, you got to keep your head on a swivel, meaning you look 360 to the extent you can, make sure there's not someone out there trying to hit you, you know. So like in football, you know, it's self-defense. You got to keep aware and keep your head on a swivel.
The third point was auditory exclusion. I mean, they relayed stories in the classroom portion about how when you're under high stress, you don't hear all that's going on around you. You maybe cue in to just what's pertinent to you. And this is also like a defensive thing if the blood's rushing and everything like that. And they tried to simulate it in the sense that they'd give our instructions. We had a firing word, or what I'll call, I guess, the trigger word. That was our cue to go ahead and actually shoot when the line was hot. And then we had there would be like left or right instructions. So you had multiple instructions, and to keep it straight is what I guess was the way of testing the auditory exclusion. Like maybe you focused on the first instruction and then lost out on, you know, I guess to go into the example, they had the trigger word would be like red or blue or up. They'd tell you before they started, and then they'd tell you how many shots you were to fire. And then, you know, invariably they'd yell out red and your trigger word was blue. And you were supposed to fire one shot, and half of the people up there would unload the whole magazine on the wrong word.
Right, they'd say, your, you know, your commence fire word is blue. Three shots on target. Ready, pink. And a couple people would shoot. Your group actually didn't. Your group was the best disciplined, I guess, or at least the active listeners. So I will say that in my class, they did that to us. And sure enough, I was probably the first one to fire on that wrong commence fire word. No, but I learned right away that, that was the wrong word. I should really pay attention to that.
And then later on, we did a cover exercise, but it kind of demonstrated the auditory issue again with left and right. You kind of forget, you know, left from right, but when you're trying to engage, you can only process so much at a time. And a lot of people forget their left from their right. They'll go the wrong way, you know, where they can't.
A lot of people forgot even the counts.
Yep, maybe they'd go right like they were supposed to, but then they would have to stop and be like, how many shots again? Yeah, so I mean, it was funny, it was all good natured, you know, nothing intimidating about the class other than there just weren't a lot of women, but that wasn't an issue for me at least. So that I guess I would push under the auditory exclusion, and I will talk about the cover more in depth in a little bit. The fourth point that they tried to simulate was skewed perception of time and adrenaline rush. And let me back up and say they couldn't really simulate either of those unless maybe you were super nervous for the class or the range time. And I guess we won't really go into that, but you know, it'll seem like maybe time is at a standstill and you have to be careful in the sense that the person that's maybe attacking you is covering a lot more ground than you would realize because time seems to be going so much slower for you.
Right. I mean, the psychological factors, the auditory exclusion, etc., really, I think we could spend a lot of time talking about and really deserves its own podcast. Maybe when we do a little bit more homework and really kind of just boiled down some really good examples, and maybe we'll talk about it later in its own podcast, because it's really important, I think, you know?
Yeah, I don't know that we can talk enough about it. I was right, so we'll maybe do a little more research and dedicate. There's going to be multiple podcasts where we go in depth, maybe.
If you know what's coming, if you've been told this stuff, you won't freak out, you know, and you won't say, oh man, why is this happening to me? You'll say, oh, okay, I can't use my fingers because right now my blood is pumping and my fine motor skills are deteriorating. Okay, I can adapt to that. If you know it's coming, you're better able to handle it. And maybe even then you can better prepare with better techniques like the paw pull and the power stroke. You do that and you ingrain that in you so you never have to get yourself in a situation where you're fumbling with stuff and wondering why.
So then, moving on to the drills themselves, what they tried to really focus on, the point of all of the drills was, I guess, balancing your speed with your accuracy and learning.
What do they call that?
Well, BSA for sure. It's just an acronym, right?
Right, right.
Focusing on the sights, really, because when you go to most indoor ranges, I would say all. I can't imagine that there's any indoor range where you're allowed to do quick draw and do any kind of simulation like we were doing out on this range because it's closed and things can bounce, ricochet around.
I'm not aware of any indoor ranges that allow you to draw from your holster.
So, I mean, the point in a real defensive situation is that going to an indoor range, at least, is going to get you really comfortable with your weapon, but it also teaches you to get that perfect sight and to take your sweet old time, and that's not what you need to have practiced and default to for a defensive situation. You need to be doing maybe some fast draw practice just around the house without doing any firing, of course. So what they were trying to do is our first drill, I think, was just, you know, drawing the weapon, and we were in a tuck ready position is what they called it. So all we had to do was punch our arms out. We had to do it two-handed. And I think I used Weaver. You could use isosceles or Weaver, but that was basically your choice. So all you had to do was punch your arms out towards the target. You didn't have to do a whole lot to align your sights when you were given your trigger word or your commence fire word. And you wanted to get your sights in perfect alignment and just see how you were shooting. And we were, they had like three lines set up at different distances from the targets, and I think we were on the middle distant one for that first perfect sight alignment. And I did not hear an instruction to say get perfect sight alignment, so in the absence of that, I ended up doing point shooting.
What is point shooting?
I just punched the gun out and shot.
You didn't use your sights?
I didn't use my sights at all. And I hit the target. I was low. First time shooting the Glock, I knew that their sights were a little different, so I was trying to kind of just guesstimate if I needed to tilt it up or down. I aired
so the first
on...
first rounds through the Glock 19 were you point shooting at it?
Yeah, I was point shooting and I went low. I was still on the target, but I was low.
Yeah.
And he was really disappointed and confused when I got back there. He's like, what were you doing? And I'm like, I point shot. He's like, that's not what you're supposed to do. I'm like, oh, well.
Absent instruction, use your sights.
That's not what I did. So, but nobody really said anything. I think they just thought I was a bad shot and didn't want to.
Well, I mean, a little part of me thought, oh man, the Glock's shooting way low. That's not good. We bought a lemon. But no, it wasn't. It was, you know, you as soon as you align the shots, the shots start going where you want them to go. It's a funny thing.
Well, it clicked because then the second drill, they specified that it was point shooting, and Al and I looked over at each other at the same time. We're like, I did it wrong. Yeah. So I did two point shooting exercises that day. But the point shooting then was at a line that was closest to the target. I would say when we punched out, none of us had more than 2 or 3 feet between the end of the barrel and the target. And this is where you're not supposed to use the sights at all. You just punch out and shoot towards center mass. Do you have anything to add to that, Al?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things they said in the balance, you know, the BSA drills, the balance between speed and accuracy drills, is that you don't have to be target accurate, meaning you don't have to group your shots to within an inch of one another. You know, you want to walk that line. You want to be combat accurate. And I think they explained to you that combat accuracy was, you know, groups about 6 inches or so. You don't need to take a lot of time to get a 6-inch group unless you're, you know, just very, very much a beginner. So they want to kind of, you know, imagine, if you will, a graph. You know, on one side, it's one column, it's accuracy, and the other column, it's speed. And you want to kind of maximize both of those. You want to be very fast and very accurate. And if you're going too fast, that'll tell by because you'll be really, really inaccurate. If you're going too slow, you can tell because you'll be super accurate. So you want to kind of walk the line between both and get that combat accurate group in as quick a time as possible. And it's something that obviously only comes with training, and this was just mostly an introduction to that idea of you don't have to be perfect in your target groups. You just want to get it on the torso and the target region, you know.
And I think those first two drills were kind of, they set the range time up, and I'm only seeing it now in retrospect. They set it up to show you the two extremes, because then we did flash sight exercises, which is where whenever that front sight is anywhere within the rear sight, you can shoot. And it was to demonstrate, you know, pushing that speed and accuracy balance, because you're going to hit center mass. I mean, when you're in a defensive situation, they're going to be pretty close to you anyway for you to start firing at them, and you're going to hit them if you've got...
Right. The flash sight picture is sort of the compromise between point shooting and taking an aimed long shot, accurate shot, meaning that, you know, the point shooting, you're just punching it out there shooting, and that's going to be within, you know, bad breath distance, close contact distance. The aimed shot would probably be a longer distance where you have a little bit of time to be able to take and measure your shot. The flash sight picture is going to be sort of that in-between area where you don't necessarily have a lot of time, but you have a little bit of time to align your sights, put it over the center mass of your target, and shoot without perfect sight alignment. It doesn't have to be perfect. You need that front sight somewhere in the neighborhood in between the rear two sights if you're using a traditional sight picture.
And so, I mean, what we did is they had us, we could fill, I think, our magazine up as full as we wanted, but we needed at least like 5 rounds. So what they had us do is take that first, give that first shot perfect sights, and then we kept our arms straight out there, and then they'd have us tilt it so the front sight was a little high of the rear sights, and then a little towards the right, a little towards the bottom, a little low basically, and then a little to the left, and you were shooting just one shot, and you could see that it was creating like a diamond pattern in the target depending on how accurate you were to begin with, of course. And then what they had you do is you went back to the tuck ready position after you'd been shown that you don't need perfect sights to hit your center mass. And then they would give you the firing or the trigger word, the commence fire word, and they'd tell you to do, you know, like empty your magazine then. And you were just going to punch it out there when you had that flash sight and go. And, you know, everything, I think everybody, well, maybe only one person out of all of us in the class had shots that didn't go on target.
Right.
So that was really telling and really encouraging, because I think that there is this mindset when you can only really practice at a range, and for a lot of people it's an indoor range, you can't do this kind of quick draw sort of practice, which is really more true to life in the situations you're probably likely to face.
Right, and I'm thinking that, you know, in all the times at the range you weren't able to empty a magazine with rapid fire, where you, I don't think you ever have tried it, at least.
I think the last time we went to the range, I tried to just pull the trigger quicker to see how my accuracy was. And it might have been when we rented the Glock 19, because okay, it was pretty smooth. Uh-huh. I don't know. Those were the drills, and that's why they covered them the way they did. And I think probably why they did them in the order they did, to show you the compromise with the flash sight. You know, you don't want to be sloppy, which the point shooting can be. And then, of course, if you're in a night setting, you can see where this would lead to making certain choices for the weapon you maybe keep at your bedside. If you want night sights or a light mounted, or, you know, wanting to be at a point where you're at muscle memory with your firearm, so that if you don't have the night sights or the light, that you are comfortable knowing that when you draw it, you're going to be aligned. All very good tips and good practice, and just really brings it home to have to do it, even though there wasn't any kind of real stress in the class itself. You have anything else to say? I guess it's time for you to talk about your cover exercise.
Yeah, at the end of the shooting portion, right before the part where people need to pass a test, they had an optional drill where they set up a cover, and you basically were told to move around the cover and fire some rounds, get back behind the cover, and then go to the other side, and then kind of repeat that. And one of the instructors, I'm not sure if he remembered me or not, but he knew that I was there to it, you know, and that I was a former graduate of that class, and asked if I wanted to volunteer. And me being my bashful self, I said, no. And then I realized he was serious, and I said, all right, fine.
And I was like, yes, because you haven't gotten to shoot your Glock yet. This is perfect.
Yeah, it was perfect. And I got to shoot the Glock. And basically he told me, you know, he basically would say 4 left, 3 right. So I would three feet behind cover. You don't want to be right directly behind the cover if you can help it. 3 feet behind the cover, I'd shuffle step left, shoot the 4 rounds, shuffle, get behind cover, shuffle step right, and fire the 3 rounds, and then get back behind cover and wait for further instruction. And basically did that till I, you went through 2 magazines worth and threw the Glock, and wow, you know, it was nice. I think I was pretty much using a flash sight picture. I tried to go really fast, and Dagny told me afterwards that all my shots seemed to be on target, so that really made me happy, you know.
Yeah, it was my turn to beam, because he was like the little model student there. He didn't confuse his left and right. He shot the proper number of times on each side. He hit the target, you know, and only a handful of people probably took them up on it. We were all kind of freezing cold by this point, and a little nervous, I think. There's performance anxiety on this drill in particular.
Yeah, it was fun, and I had a really good time, and the Glock recoil was nothing, and functionality was 100%. I was able to rapid fire with no problems, and all in all, just really, really happy, and I was glad I finally got to warm up a little bit with a little shooting drill.
Yeah, and then we had the test portion, which I won't really go into. There's nothing to really report on that, and then we
Easy peasy.
Yep, he headed home. So I guess that probably wraps up, unless you can think of anything else, Al.
Well, like I said, we're on, like Dagny said earlier, we're on the road. We're on vacation. We couldn't leave all of you lovely people empty-handed, so we definitely wanted to get a podcast, and we'll probably upload it on the road here. We're heading south, and we might be driving through your towns. So think of us, pray for us while we travel, and like Dagny said, we might have a special surprise. I don't want to jinx it, and we're going to try and do something on our route that might be a little fun. So anyways, that's it for me. Do you have any other thoughts?
Nope, no other thoughts. Feel free to email us, ccwpodcast@gmail.com. And otherwise, stay tuned for the surprise.
Bye.